One of the foremost authorities on the subject of the Constitution in our day is John Eismo, who's a law professor. I was just about to say retired law professor, but I'm not quite sure what the deal is on that. Anyway, John Eismo is also a prolific author on the Constitution. One of the classic books he's written is called Christianity and the Constitution. He's even taught law or subjects on the Constitution in other countries, including in Ukraine. And we're going to talk about Ukraine right now and the Constitution. This is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. And John Eismo, thank you so much for joining us again. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity to be with you again, Jerry. And yes, I did retire from the Thomas Goode Jones School of Law, but I am teaching right now for the Oakbrook College of Law in California and have no plans to retire in the near future.
Oh, okay. So you are still a law professor, and you, of course, you wrote that, well, I shouldn't say of course, to you and I, it's an of course, but for those not familiar with it, I think it's something worth pointing out. You wrote a three-volume massive set of books for Nordskog Publishing on law, and it was really like a landmark type study. I forgot the exact name of that series, but it's a profound contribution to the whole subject.
Historical and theological foundations of law, that's correct.
Okay, so now, when you said to me off the air that you've actually given seminars in Ukraine on the American Constitution or a constitutional government, this made me think about something that Donald Lutz once said many years ago. He said the American Constitution is actually the model constitution that has been followed in all kinds of different countries around the world. Is that correct, or did I, you know, I hope I've understood him correctly, but what are your thoughts on that? Is the U.S. Constitution kind of almost a prototype of what's used around in different countries, even if they don't follow it closely?
Certainly, dozens of countries all around the world have modeled their constitutional systems after the United States Constitution, but none of them can be exactly alike. I mean, any constitutional system has to be based on eternal principles, but also has to be geared to the unique situations in each country. And when we made constitutional proposals for Ukraine back in 2015, we didn't suggest they simply adopt the United States Constitution. We suggested they take their current constitution and implement some principles that are conducive to a constitutional republic there. This was right after the Maidan Revolution of 2014, where thousands of residents of Kyiv and other parts of Ukraine actually had to take up bricks off the street to fight off the pro-Russian police and soldiers. That's something we need to remember next time they talk about taking our guns. But anyway, at this time, there were quite a few people in government and in the law schools, the churches, and others there that, first of all, they definitely didn't want a Russian model. And secondly, they didn't really want a European economic community model either. And so they were looking to some of us in America to present to them an idea of a constitutional system. And so part of what we did is we took the constitution that Ukraine had, suggested a few changes in it, and even suggested two possibilities. One was a one-house Rada or parliament, and the other was a two-house. One other thing that I had suggested at the time, knowing that there were problems in the Crimea and in Donetsk and Luhansk, those are the oblasts or provinces in the eastern part of Ukraine that have substantial Russian influence and probably Russian sentiment, I suggested making them semi-autonomous oblasts or provinces, and thinking that that would be a good way of possibly diffusing a situation, and they'd be less likely to be a thorn in their side if they were semi-autonomous. I don't know if that would have averted anything, if they'd followed that advice or not, but shortly after I had been there a couple of times lecturing, shortly after that, the Russian invasion of the Crimea took place, and all of this was put on hold.
Okay, first of all, just to give us perspective here, you keep referring to we. We were there, we did this, we proposed that. Who's the we in this, John?
several other evangelical Christians with a group that's known as the American Pastors Network. And those included one who had been a legislator and other missionary and so on. We worked with people, like, for example, I had a translator there who was from Crimea, and he was a Baptist pastor. But anyway, it was quite a number of people in Ukraine and supporters in the United States as well.
And this is so fascinating to me. It seems like every time I try and read about Ukraine, I'm not talking about the present war included, but it seems like since, you know, the implosion of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, God has been at work in a very special way through different parts of Ukraine in terms of Christianity. I mean, for example, I know a music minister that started sacred music for, you know, that hadn't been heard under the communists, including a lot of Russian classic sacred music. And that was one way of reaching people. And then he was talking about the Baptist churches have been very active and so forth in Ukraine. So that's a very interesting thing. I wonder if the Christian, you know, the spread of the gospel in some ways has made many of the Ukrainians resilient and willing to, you know, make a stand in their country right now as it's being invaded.
I think it certainly has. And I'd point out, for example, in addition to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is separate from the Russian Orthodox Church, that in addition to that, I am told that there are more evangelicals per capita in Ukraine than in any other country in Europe.
Wow.
And in any other country in the Eurasian continent, with the exception of South Korea.
Wow. Now, explain to me, what is Putin's goal? And on occasion, you'll read something like where it says, well, to Putin, this is a religious war, and that he somehow justifying it in the name of some form of Christianity. And I'm thinking, what? You know, what Bible is he reading? But explain about religion and this conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
That is difficult to explain because who really knows the mind of Putin? And I have believed in the past that he probably was no longer a communist and that his goal was more to recreate the old Russia in the tradition of the old czars, but he has made statements too that he has seen things about communism that he admires. He's also in his direction trying to retake the old Soviet republics. That seems like more recreating the old USSR. So it's hard to really say what his mindset is. Also, it's not really certain what his religious beliefs are. Certainly, he sees the Orthodox Church of Russia, which again is not the same as the Ukrainian Orthodox, but he sees the Russian Orthodox Church as being very central to Russia, part of Russia's soul and character, and he believes that the future of Russia has to be tied in with the Russian Orthodox Church, whether that's because he believes in its doctrines or whether he just finds that useful, I don't think any of us can really say for sure.
Well, when you were in Ukraine and you were there, you said in 2015, as part of a group, you were invited in and you were talking about constitutional principles and so forth. What was your own experience being in Ukraine? What was your experience with the Ukrainian people?
I really, really came to love the Ukrainian people, and I just came to admire them tremendously. And like I say, these are people who took up bricks off the streets to fight off the pro-Russian soldiers. And it seems like everybody else is very surprised at the strength of the Ukrainian resistance. I'm not surprised at all based on what I saw. And I do think that the United States could be doing more to help them, and I don't favor sending in boots on the ground. The Ukrainians don't want that, but I believe we could set up a no-fly zone, and I'd probably go a step further than that, and I'd probably even bring in close air support. You think of that 40-mile-long convoy of Russian military vehicles, and you think about what a American stealth fighter could do with those in a matter of a few minutes and so on. I think we could make a lot of difference with air support, which is where we're strongest.
Can you explain exactly what don't-fly zone means?
Basically, what that means is that you're simply telling the Russians, you're not going to be flying in this area, and if you are, you're going to be shot down. And, of course, having the capacity to do that. Now, of course, it'd be preferable if we could do that to our NATO allies. But if necessary, I think that's something that we ought to even be doing ourselves. Let me point one thing else out in regard to Ukraine, too. Right after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, there were quite a stockpile of nuclear weapons that were left in Ukraine, over 500, some say as many as 1,000. In fact, Ukraine at that point had more nuclear weapons than any other country in the world except the United States and Russia. And President Clinton, in his efforts to promote non-proliferation, persuaded Ukraine to give up those weapons, and they ended up mostly going to Russia in return for a firm promise from the United States and the United Kingdom that we would defend Ukraine if they were ever attacked. So I believe we have an obligation here, a commitment that is every bit as firm as the NATO commitment.
Wow. You know, it's so interesting, too. There's almost a lesson here, as you were kind of referencing earlier, that you don't want to necessarily go the route of disarmament, because, you know, it's like sometimes, for example, after some of these shootings, and then some people say, oh, you know, the problem is all the guns. And it's like, okay, great. What do you want to do? Turn the rest of the country into Chicago, where they have very strict gun laws, but only the law-abiding citizens obey those gun laws. The criminals certainly don't. So there's a principle here on armament, isn't there?
I think that applies on both the individual level and the national level. That the plain fact of the matter is that sometimes the only solution to a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Yeah. And sometimes the only solution to a bad nation with a nuke is a good nation with a nuke.
Hmm. Wow. Okay, we have about 2 minutes left. What else do you want to say about the whole Ukraine situation? Do you see a positive outcome in this scenario?
Well, here's what I would do. First of all, I think Putin needs to be convinced he's made a mistake, and he's already possibly convinced of that. Next, you need to give him a way that he can change course without losing face. And I think the way to do that would be to let him say that for the provinces of Crimea and Luhansk and Donetsk, that, well, rather than just saying, we'll give them to the Soviet Union or we'll give them to Russia, I would say rather, as at least an initial position, that we would have internationally supervised elections in those provinces to determine their future. That way Putin could say, okay, that's what I was really trying to achieve, mission accomplished, I return in victory. And in other words, to get somebody to change course, you've got to enable them to do it without losing face, especially somebody like Putin. And that might work.
Any comments about Zelensky? And by the way, I mean, I've heard some people denounce him, but I've heard other people liken him to Winston Churchill. We have 1 minute left. Zelensky.
Well, I would say you look to Zelensky, that's after I came there, but Zelensky, I think, has really, really performed amazingly there. And he's inherited a country that has a lot of corruption, frankly, in Ukraine right now, and traditionally in Ukraine. Bribing government officials to do their job is kind of like tipping a waitress, as they see it. Mm. He came in to eliminate corruption, and you can't just do that overnight. But I think he has shown himself so far to be an amazing leader, and I think we need to back him. I will say, too, that as far as Trudeau and others in foreign affairs, that he's naive about who his potential friends and enemies really are. But nevertheless, I think he's on the right side, and we should support him.
All right. John Eidsmo, thank you so much for all your insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jerry. You're doing a great job.